Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Jontaya Alexander, Melinda Davis, Sergio Harris, Joshua Hoy Lucchesi, Yamil Martinez Andrade, Devazia Turner. Sacramento is mourning the lives taken this weekend. 12 others are recovering from injuries following Sunday's mass shooting in downtown. Two vigils took place last night, but the pain is far from over. Sacramento police have announced a second arrest in connection to the shooting. The two men are brothers. Their charges are in relation to the shooting, but do not involve the homicides, according to the district attorney's office. The investigation is complex. It encompasses more than 100 bullet casings and 170 video or photos submitted by the public. People are encouraged to submit any images to a QR code that Sacramento police posted online. And the trauma is widespread. Sacramento County has opened a family assistance center at Cal Expo to provide services to families and victims. We'll learn more about that later in the hour, but first, we're joined by former Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn, who retired in December after 27 years with Sacramento Police and 33 overall in law enforcement. Good morning, Chief Hahn, or former Chief Hahn.
Good morning, Vicky.
There is a lot of information and questions that are coming at us, and you've been very public talking about this. What's missing from this conversation?
Well, I don't know that anything's missing just 2 days afterwards, because things take a while to wrap your head around this and get over the shock. But what is typically missing from these things is the long-term solutions on how we're going to come together, especially in such a divisive environment that we're in, and holistically find solutions that are good for all communities. So instead of having to hold people accountable, they don't end up shooting what we've now heard in the last day, that's over 100 rounds in an extremely crowded public area.
Yeah. You just retired in December after more than 30 years in law enforcement, 27 of which in your hometown of Sacramento. Was it hard not to be there and respond?
Yeah, I don't know if something's wrong with me or not, but I'm very happy with being retired and not being a police chief anymore. But when things like this happen in my city, there is a part of me that wishes I was there to help the community get through it. But, you know, we all need to be part of getting our community through it. So it's not just the families, of course, who are devastated and have to figure out how they're going to go on without a loved one. But also our community as a whole and the feeling of safety or lack thereof in whether it's downtown or the ongoing violence that we see and often don't talk enough about in our communities, in our neighborhoods. But I'm sure the first thing people think about if they are going downtown in the near future is this. And are they safe? And should they go there or should they go somewhere else? And that is not good for our city or for regardless of where you're at in our city, that is not good for us.
What do you say to people in the city who are weighing that, whether it's safe?
Well, it's hard to say factually that it's safe when you just had a massive shooting down there. So I think we as a community should be saying, what are we doing to ensure that it's safe, not only downtown, and I will continue to say this, but also in our neighborhoods that have experienced violence. You know, not exactly like this, but the number of people shot and killed for sure is way more in some of our neighborhoods than just the other night. So I think we need to continue to have conversations and take actions collaboratively instead of attacking each other on how we're going to change, you know, things like poverty and hope and the feeling of like, why not? I don't have anything, you know, that's telling me not to do this. And so now I've resolved my issues with violence. I mean, not too long ago, we had a shooting on the freeway over road rage. That's now when somebody cuts you off, you shoot them. So even though those are far and few between, considering the number of people that are in our community and that come to our city every day, but it makes people feel unsafe. And that is not good for any city and any community.
Right. And I think when you bring up that road rage shooting, I mean, it's important to slow down because, you know, it's like we forget that these things happen in a very short period of time, some within months or weeks of each other. You know, the current chief, Kathy Lester, called this the worst mass shooting in city history. But in that spirit, it follows another mass shooting just weeks prior at a church in the Arden neighborhood. I mean, that is unprecedented for Sacramento. Do you view these as isolated, given that gun violence has been increasing across the country? And you were a guest on that matter back in November.
Yeah, we also had a mass shooting last summer in Old Sacramento. Even though part of me is surprised when this happens in our city, I think it's just natural to be in kind of shock when something like this happens, especially so close to home. On the other hand, I'm not surprised because I've seen the level of violence that can occur. And I think we all have to realize when violence rises in any community, in any city, which it's on the rise significantly across our country, when gang activity is on the rise, not that this was a gang shooting or not, but just in general, when gang activity is on the rise, when hate crimes are on the rise, hate membership is on the rise, it means something's wrong in society. It means we're missing something because people are joining those entities. People are lashing out with violence because they're missing something. You join a gang because you want to be part of something. You want people to care about you. You're missing something. So we have to realize crime is on the rise and we can't keep going from one extreme to the other. Okay, we're going to do zero tolerance, heavy law enforcement. We're going to enact a bunch of laws and lock people away forever. That's our sole response. Or we're not going to have any law enforcement or depleted law enforcement. We're going to send social workers and community groups. Those extremes are not the answer. And we continue to do them throughout history. I grew up in the, you know, during the crack epidemic in Oak Park, and that's where three strikes came from, zero tolerance. And look what it did to our relationships. It worsened an already not well relationship between law enforcement and community. It, in my opinion, destroyed some parts of communities, and we're living with that today. The answer is we need all of the above. We need social services. We need community groups. We need law enforcement, all working together to give each individual more of what they need so they don't end up on a Sunday morning, Saturday night, shooting at somebody. And I think it's pretty clear now they've also shot a lot of people that maybe they weren't intending on shooting.
I asked the mayor this yesterday. You know, California has some of the strictest gun laws in the country. I've personally covered six mass shootings, five of which in California. Why do laws fall short?
Well, because again, like I said, in collaboration, laws by themselves don't work. We've already seen one of the guns recovered was illegal. So that's already against the law. We see Chicago has probably, arguably, the strictest gun laws in the country, and they probably are leading the country right now in gun violence. Laws are important, and I think we should look at the rules in regards to guns and how you get them. I mean, you can order them online. You can switch a handgun to a fully automatic in your living room of your home. So I think we should look at reasonable gun laws and evaluate our laws and see if that's where we want. But that by itself is not going to stop somebody from illegally obtaining a gun and going to use it. So we need that and a myriad of other things. But too often we want the simple solution. It's not going to happen overnight. We didn't get here overnight. And so we need to work together. And unfortunately, as I'm sure you're all too aware of, our environment right now is very divisive. We tend to attack each other instead of learning from each other. I'll be the first to tell you law enforcement has work to do. But I'll be the first to tell you that we have to have law enforcement too. We can't do without it. So instead, what we end up doing is talking and working on these extremes, because that's what we talk about all the time. That's what gets all the attention. And we never actually work on the stuff that needs to be worked on because we're too busy dealing with the extremes on both ends.
You know, you bring up the fact that this happened in downtown, but we need to be focused on city issues and underserved communities. I brought this question to city leaders yesterday and each had varying responses. And the argument from community activists that had this happened elsewhere in the city, in the north or the south part of the city, this wouldn't have been given as much attention or as much compassion, given that you've been with SAC PD for decades. You know, you had a brief intermission with Roseville PD for 6 years. What is your response to that?
I think that's true and not true. So I think a mass shooting of this level would have got attention in any neighborhood just because it's so large. But the reality is, the truth is, we have shootings every single day in our neighborhoods. We have people dying every week in our neighborhoods. And depending on where it is, it gets attention. In other neighborhoods, it does not get attention. And I understand why the businesses downtown are so frustrated I'm frustrated for them. They've dealt with a lot over the last couple of years in the business associations and, you know, shootings and disarray in front of their businesses is not good for business. And that's their livelihood. So I understand why they want the city to help. And I understand why the city wants to help. But the reality is when we have a couple of shootings downtown, we end up giving millions of dollars to downtown. We have shootings every day in Del Paso Heights and Meadowview and Oak Park. And we don't give money to those neighborhoods for lighting and cameras and those sort of things. So it's a fact. And we have to, you know, the people involved in this shooting were out at an entertainment district in nightclubs and restaurants and things like that. My guess is not very many, if any, lived right there. There's not very much housing right there. They all live in our neighborhoods. And so that activity came downtown and we ignore our neighborhoods quite frequently. And so we just need to come together and understand that all lives, all communities are valuable in our city, and we need to support them. It's not support downtown. We need to support downtown and our neighborhoods.
What sticks with me are the images from the morning following the shooting. Loved ones were just waiting for the worst, and the bodies of six victims were laying in the street. The SACB reported that they remained there for more than 18 hours. Can you help us understand why?
Yeah, I don't know why, because I'm not in the police department anymore. But I think it's also important to understand that as tragic as this is, and I have some insight into what it's like to lose a loved one. My younger brother was killed not too far from actually where this mass shooting happened after he got involved in the drug world and was murdered by a gun in our city. And I responded to the call. I identified him. I had to call my mom. So I get the trauma and the devastation it has on a family. But at some point, the people that have already been arrested and whoever else will get arrested for this tragedy are going to end up in court. And there has to be evidence and facts that are presented in a methodical way so they're truly held accountable. And so my guess is part of that is evidence collection, working with the coroner's office to ensure that everything is documented. So when you get to court, you can recreate what happened and prove exactly who's responsible and what their role was in it. And so that's what I'm guessing is why that took so long, because this is a massive scene. If you remember, the police department blocked off blocks. And I think yesterday they announced that there was over 100 shell casings. Well, each one of those have to be picked up, photographed, documented, and there's surely plenty of other evidence throughout that scene. So that would be my guess why that lasted so long.
Finally, former Chief Hahn, I mean, you've been very open about your life story. I mean, you just mentioned you grew up in Oak Park during the 80s. You've also said adoption saved your life. You know, I've learned and you've openly shared as a teenager, you were arrested and said it was one of the most formative moments in your life. And you live with loss. You mention your brother, and that isn't the only murder that you've witnessed in your life. You're also the first Black police chief for both Sacramento and Roseville. I say this not to kick off a biography, but now that you're in another phase of your life without a badge, where do you see your role and purpose?
Yeah, I don't know all that I'll be doing. I'm still trying to search that out and figure that out. But I can tell you, no matter what like formal job I'll have or jobs I'll have, for the rest of my life, I will continue to carry on really what I think is the work of my mom, who was a very selfless person, that everything she did was to help others. And I see as a police chief, as a retired police chief with the experiences, both personal and professional, I see where we're lacking. We are leaving neighborhoods behind. We're leaving certain people behind, and we're not doing enough to support those communities so people have the same opportunities that they do in others. I mean, you can just drive through communities, not just in Sacramento, but the surrounding neighborhoods, and visually see the difference of the investment that we have, both government investment and private investment in communities. And the community I grew up in, I didn't know this growing up in, wasn't always like that. Oak Park used to be a very thriving community, upper middle class community. It wasn't when I was living there, but we changed that by decisions that our leaders made And that gives me hope because that means that's human made. That's not inevitable. And so we can change it back to where it's a thriving neighborhood and the young people that are growing up don't grow up in the environment that I grew up in. Luckily, my mom inside our home was very stable. But, you know, a lot of kids are growing up in chaos. And that is very challenging to be healthy when you grow up around trauma and chaos on a daily, every minute basis.
Bringing up Oak Park, when you go to the north part along Broadway with all the development, are you satisfied with that?
No, because you see gentrification and everything. By the way, that's the part of Oak Park I grew up in. On one hand, the corner of 35th and Broadway that used to be the second downtown, the thriving neighborhood in the 50s and the 40s. When I grew up, that was a drug haven, prostitution location. The Woodruff Hotel was nowhere you wanted to be. So I'm thrilled when I see it now, the Guild Theater being used again. I had never been into the Guild Theater until maybe 10 years ago because it was always shuttered. And I grew up two blocks from there. So there's really good things happening, but I think we have to figure out ways that we don't displace people when the neighborhood recovers, that they become part of that recovery and they thrive as part of that recovery because they are what made Oak Park thrive during the bad times. I loved growing up in Oak Park. I had a blast. It was a very tight-knit community, but there was violence all around you. There was drugs and there was things that became normalized, but there was a lot of great things about Oak Park too. And those folks that made Oak Park great when I was there need to be part of the thriving part of Oak Park too.
Yeah, who does it benefit?
Yes.
Former Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we'll learn more about the Family Assistance Center at Cal Expo to provide services to victims and families, as well as have a conversation about navigating trauma and grief. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We have all felt the loss from Sunday's shooting in one way or another. Over the past 48 hours, many of us have been processing what happened and may even be looking for ways to cope. Family members and loved ones have been offered mental health resources. Sacramento County opened up a Family Assistance Center at Cal Expo, open Monday through Friday from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. for victims and families. One of the organizations offering services is the Law Enforcement Chaplaincy of Sacramento. Joining us now is Senior Chaplain Mindy Russell. Welcome back, Mindy.
Hi, Vicki. Good to see you.
Mindy, you joined us just 4 weeks ago following a shooting at a church in the Arden neighborhood. Three children and a chaperone were killed. We're back here again. We're back here again, Mindy. How do you reflect on that?
Well, the first thing I want to say is thank you that you named every deceased person's name. They are owed that, to give them that dignity to be remembered. So I so appreciate that. How do we get back here again? Why is it that this one is even compared to that one? Is because it's senseless. However, those two shootings with the children and the chaperone, unfortunately, there was a lot of red flags. This one, is so different. This is a time where people went out to have fun, Vicki, to go to a bar, dance, laugh, whatever. And the tragedy is that whether they ever find out if it was random completely or it was specific and there were other people that were involved, doesn't matter. We don't minimize this at all. The fact is that it was something that could have been prevented.
How do you curate, or do you curate your support for each crisis and tragedy and loss? Because although, you know, when you're talking about what happened in the Arden Church shooting, that was senseless, you know, or there were, no, it was senseless, but there were also red flags. You know, if you talk to community activists, we just heard from Chief Hahn, I mean, they would argue there are more systemic red flags when it comes to this type of gun violence as well. How do you curate how you offer support and care for people and help them heal and understand and process?
Well, every one of the chaplains are trauma-informed, trauma-trained, trauma responders. And although there is a way to look at what to look for in physical reactions, mental reactions, behavior reactions, spiritual reactions, there is a gamut from the extremes both ways. So nobody has all the trauma reactions. One kid loses their appetite, the other one eats a lot. And so when we go into any kind of trauma, we do not cookie cut them and go, yeah, we've been to a shooting. Yeah, we've been to a suicide. Yeah, it's the same way. Because the X factor is the individuals that come to be. The deceased, the wounded, and the family and friends. And I don't want to lose the fact that the business with all their employees are affected as well. Because here's the thing. There is this huge thing called survival guilt. And I read on the Facebook, people were saying, I was just there an hour ago. I was an Uber driver there, blah, blah, blah. And survivor guilt is, I'm sorry that those people were killed or wounded, but I'm glad it didn't happen to me. Mm-hmm. And that is something that needs to be addressed, because that guilt is very real, but it needs to be addressed.
I know oftentimes you and your team just spring into action. How were you involved in the immediate aftermath of what unfolded early Sunday morning?
Well, we have such a great relationship with all the police departments that we serve. And so we will get the call. And a lot of times when it is pure chaos, like it was when they first responded, we might get, there's been a shooting, standby. Well, we start getting our team together, and it could be anywhere from 2 to, as we saw it starting to develop, we started getting everybody to the point that it's all hands on deck. We will adapt to the needs of the department, but we also, behind the scenes, want to take care of the officers' families, because their children and their spouses are extremely sensitive to what they're responding to. And they have to be able to support their family members that are there trying to solve this crime.
The county has now started a family assistance center. It is open Monday through Friday. You and your team will be there. For a lot of people, this is the first time they're really confronted with navigating something on this level. What can they expect when they arrive there?
So family assistance centers were really started developing well after the Oklahoma bombing. The one I was in charge of was the New York Ground Zero one. And it really does make a difference. I was asked that. What's with this family assistance center? Well, let me explain. What's going to happen is the family and friends of this shooting, and that is also the wounded, will come, because the organizations, the DA's office, the LECS, and American Red Cross, we are a healthy triad. The DA is going to have all that's going to be needed in the areas once they're captured, the bad guys are captured, and the court system and everything that's going to happen in the future. Our LECS chaplains, again, are training them to be in the moment, but also to start processing. And then American Red Cross is a lot of the times the food, the accommodations, that kind of thing. But what one thing about our chaplains is we know that these people are feeling like they're victims, you know, and victims focus on what they can't control. We help them start processing so that they get better instead of bitter. And that process helps them turn to survivors that focus on what they can control. And eventually, when they have work through all this process that they become victors, and who's in control. So we don't want them to stay victims and filter their lives now from this incident.
The road to healing and processing can be years. What follow-up services do you provide to those who need it?
So every family will be assigned a support person. And because everybody has different relationships, different needs, different things that need to be addressed. So everybody will have their own person to take care of. And then that way they feel like they're heard. They feel like even though they're not alone, because there's a whole support system out there that has experienced the same similar thing, that they are going to be taken care of, and their answers to their questions will be quick and swift, instead of, I've been sitting on the phone for, you know, hours because other people have gone before me.
Hmm. I think it's an important reminder. We talked about this a month ago, you know, distinguishing what traumatic grief is. What is traumatic grief?
So trauma is based on fear, and grief is focused on loss. Now you add those two together and it becomes overlaid with two extremes. So we already know, everybody who has ever lost someone knows that there's stages and there's emotions attached, and that it is the three-part person. When we grieve physically, mentally, and spiritually. Now you add one more component. So all of those stages are there. Now you add that next component, which is traumatic trauma. And traumatic or trauma grief adds that component of fear, which can be fear of what's going to happen to me, fear of what am I going to do now. It's very complicated because of the fear. And there's different symptoms that come into play that's not necessarily with just grief. They get preoccupied with the deceased because it was so sudden and it was so out of range. Who, you know, quite frankly, Vicki, nobody thinks it's going to happen to them. Nobody. Not that my loved one's going to get murdered. So when it is off the charts, and our belief values are, you know, really challenged. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of different unsolved memories, unresolved memories, a lot of emotions that are literally longing for that person because we didn't get to say goodbye. Yeah, so there's a lot more. And what we want to try to do is help them in the future, not right now. You don't really start that until after the funeral. But what you want to try to do is get them to separate the trauma from the grief so they can literally grieve the loss of their loved one, but deal with the trauma because that's a traumatic stress.
I mean, what you're talking about is uncharted territory for so many people until they are actually confronted with it. And for those of us who weren't directly impacted, but perhaps someone knows someone and they want to help, how should we approach them? What should we not do, even if it's well-intentioned?
Good question, Vicki. First of all, we are a community of families in Sacramento. And I heard retired Chief Han say that there's a lot of diversity. I truly believe these are the kind of things that we can get more unified than ever. Again, going back to Ground Zero, we talk about 9/11, but what about 9/12? When we stood shoulder to shoulder, locked arms, it didn't matter if you were Black, white, African-American, it didn't matter. We were all in this together. This is an opportunity for the leaders of our city to bring together. So that vigils last night, wonderful. If you don't know, you do not have to ask. Do you know anybody that was at that bar that night? Do you know the deceased? It doesn't matter. We're grieving. Our whole city is grieving. And so what we want to do is be great listeners. How can I help you is so much better than I understand. So there's cliches that we say that in times like this, don't say them. You know, I understand. You need anything, just give me a call. How about if I check on you tomorrow? And the people that are closer and closer to the families that are affected, be great listeners. You don't have to solve anything, and your words are literally, I'm sorry this happened, let me help you, instead of, you know, let's get over it.
Yeah, I saw a quote on social media. It's like, you may understand, but you don't get it. So, you know, having that humility. You know, finally, Chaplain Russell, you know, the news is nonstop. We care. We want to be engaged. When do we hit the pause button and take a break?
Ah, wow. I am a firm advocate. Turn off the television and the radio if it's overwhelming.
And the phone.
And the phone and the social media. Here is the thing. We should be very informed of what's going on, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's the shooting, whether it's something happened in our neighborhood. Be informed, but don't be impressed with the negative. And what I mean by that is there are so many people that just dwell on the negative and the pain and the sorrow and all of that, that there is some wonderful things that are happening. So I talk about reframe. Take time to be informed, then step away and reframe by all the good that's coming out of this. It's not minimizing the deaths or the wounded. It is literally taking control back of an uncontrollable situation. How do you reframe? To hear the families coming together, to have the community having vigils, that's a reframe. Make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll end on that note. Senior Chaplain Mindy Russell is the Executive Director of the Law Enforcement Chaplaincy at Sacramento. Thank you so much.
I'm so privileged to be here. Call me anytime, Vicki.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're discussing the resources available to help those impacted by Sunday's mass shooting. We're going to continue to focus on Sacramento County's Family Assistance Center, Cal Expo for Families and Victims. Joining us now is Nina Acosta, the program manager for the District Attorney's Witness and Victim Assistance Program. Nina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start off by telling us more about the Victim Witness Assistance Program, what you all do, who your advocates are, and the services that you offer?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I have a team of 17 victim witness advocates. We're all master's level social workers by training. We're also all trauma trained and crisis trained for situations like this. During the week, we support the district attorney's office by working with all of the victims of crime that happens, unfortunately, every day in Sacramento. So our victims meet with all of our victim advocates meet with victims of crime. We talk about what has happened. We help provide emotional support for those victims as they're really just trying to grasp what has happened. And then we work in partnership with the district attorneys to walk through the criminal justice system with victims. A lot of times people have never had any encounters with the criminal justice system. It can be very intimidating, very scary. And we really talk to them about what that process looks like, what it's going to be like to go to court, what it's like to have to face the defendant in court, and really support them through that process. And that's part of what we do. We also do a lot of crisis intervention with victims on a daily basis. You never know when a trauma response is going to happen after you've been a victim of a crime. And so our advocates work with victims on a daily basis, checking in with them, processing through what has happened, providing that ongoing support for them throughout this whole process. And one of the unique things about the work that we do is that our services never end. The criminal court case might be resolved, but the victims continually reach out. We have ongoing support group for homicide victims that we manage and facilitate. We also connect with community resources, do a lot of outreach and community partnering with ongoing services for anyone that's been affected by crime in Sacramento.
You and your team will be at the Assistance Center at Cal Expo for Victims and Their Families. You know, and as you mentioned, this very likely will be their first time encountering something like this. When they walk in and they may be feeling a little bit unsure or even anxious about what to expect, what should they expect when they walk into the center?
So when they walk in, they're going to be met by a chaplain from the law enforcement chaplaincy group and one of my victim advocates. So we walk in with them and we talk to them about what their needs are. We ask them how they're related to the victim that they're coming in to receive services for. We sit with them and we talk to them about what's happening, where they're at emotionally, really try to assess where to go for them, sit with them in where they're feeling. Some of them are coming in and don't know how they're feeling, and that's completely normal. And so we just sit and we talk about things and we ask them about their loved ones. We asked them about their night before this happened and what was going on. Try to get them into the present sense and really kind of focus on what is it that your immediate needs are? How can we assist with that? If they're in an already heightened emotional state, we work with them and do that crisis intervention right then and there and talk through the emotions and their experience, do some of the mindfulness work that will help reduce their heart rates and be able to meet them where they're at. The biggest thing that we do right now is being able to help them really understand what happened. A lot of folks are coming in still in a state of shock and not really understanding everything that's happening and going on around them. And then we really help them to connect with what are their wishes for a funeral and burial if they were one of the homicide victims. If their loved one's in the hospital, we talk about how they can speak with their loved one under COVID times and some of the parameters at the local hospitals and how we can support them through this. We really do wrap our arms around everybody that comes in and really get them supported.
You said yesterday on a news outlet that sometimes trauma sneaks up on folks. And that's really, that's so poignant. Why is it imperative to seek help even if you don't feel like you need it at that moment?
So one of the things that we see after a mass victimization is that there's a lot of people that are affected that don't realize that they were affected because they weren't on the scene. So everybody knows that the people that were present or even in the vicinity when it happened, that they would have trauma. You know, they might have a startle response when they hear a car backfire or something like that. And, but there's a lot of people that watched it on the news. There's a lot of people that are friends and family of people that were at the incident. And they don't necessarily think that they have a trauma response because they weren't there. And that's not necessarily true. Some of the things can show up where you're at work and, you know, you provided support to your family or your friends and you're always on call. And then all of a sudden you're not able to concentrate and you don't know why. That's not something that's happened before. But somehow you don't connect that to the fact that you have seen the news coverage, you have been talking to a friend or a family member that has been directly impacted by the incident. You don't connect those two as a trauma response because you weren't physically at the incident. And it can manifest in different ways. It can be sleep disturbances. It can be trouble with eating too much, over drinking more than you normally do. And one of the things that we recommend is to reach out. We really want to encourage people to reach out, even if they are not sure. And we'll talk you through that and we'll see, and we'll be able to connect information, connect you to resources, give you information of what to look for. There's a lot of different signs of trauma that people don't necessarily think are related to trauma.
Yeah. Finally, for people who want to help but don't know how, the Family Assistance Center is specifically for victims and their families. But for those who want to help in the community, what do you recommend?
The first thing I recommend is to listen. And the other thing is a lot of people reach out and say, hey, I'm here if you need anything. The one of the great things to do is to show up with a meal and just say, I'm ready to listen. Sitting with people in it, because, again, a lot of people are still in a state of shock right now. They're still trying to process what happened. And our brains are amazing in protecting us from that. That fight or flight kicks in and it doesn't necessarily show up as an adrenaline rush. It could just be that it's swirling around in there, but it shows up, like I said, in sleep disturbances or lack of concentration and things like that. So those in the community, just get involved, show up with for people that you know are being affected or might be affected. Come and contact us and get the resources of signs and symptoms to look for in people that may be affected by this and not know it. And then reach out to us and we're happy to connect and work with the community. But one of the best things that one of the victims told us the other day is that people just showed up and they came and said, you know, can we help you with housework? Can we bring a meal? Just because I want to give you the space to be able to process what's going on, to make the arrangements you need to make. So those tangible things, once you are able to process through, it's so invaluable as members of the community.
Nina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Yeah, it was really, really great advice. Very grounding. Nina Acosta is the program director for the District Attorney's Witness and Victim Assistance Program. The Family Assistance Center at Cal Expo will be open Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. for victims and families. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. A full 3 months into 2022, and while COVID isn't gone for good, we haven't seen a 1.6 positivity rate since a year ago. Deaths are down. Hospitalizations are at such a low point that two local hospitals, including UC Davis Medical Center, recently reported having zero COVID ICU patients. But the latest Omicron variant is circulating, and in parts of Asia, entire cities like Shanghai are being shut down. So there is concern that this is a foreshadowing of what's to come. For context and perspective, we welcome back Dr. Dean Blumberg, Chief of Pediatric Diseases at UC Davis Medical Center. Good morning, Dr. Blumberg.
Good morning, Vicki. How are you today?
I'm doing good. Thank you for joining us. I'm curious, Doctor, how are you viewing the state of COVID, and not in California, but also greater Sacramento right now?
You know, things are good right now. There's a relatively low rate of transmission compared to previous months. And the diseases that we're seeing in people, it's been relatively mild. So it's been more outpatient disease rather than severe disease resulting in hospitalization or death. And that's resulting in a relatively low hospitalization rate.
Yeah, I believe since the last time we had you on, one of the biggest developments was that many school districts have moved to mask optional for several weeks now. What have you been seeing when it comes to school children and older students over the past few weeks, specifically since your focus is pediatrics?
Yeah, well, children continue to get the occasional infection, but again, it tends to be mild and an outpatient illness rather than resulting in hospitalization like we were seeing before. And we think this is because most people at this point in the pandemic, including most school-age children, have at least partial immunity. They've either been immunized or the last Omicron surge, which had such high rates of transmission, then they were infected during that surge that peaked in January. So that if they do get another infection at this point, they have partial immunity, that it's a mild outpatient illness, more like a cold or flu, and they're less likely to result in a severe disease.
What can you tell us about the current variants that are becoming more dominant and more of a concern here?
Yeah, so the Omicron subvariant is a BA2. That's of concern. It's about 30 to 80% more transmissible than the original Omicron strain. And it now accounts for almost 3/4 of the circulating strains in the U.S. And when we've seen this before in the UK and Denmark and other European countries, we've seen once it gets to be that high, once it gets to be over 50%, that may result in a surge. And they're currently seeing that in the UK and in several countries in Europe.
Why are some cities, like in parts of Asia, Shanghai, why are they being shut down because of COVID outbreaks? Well, here in California and Sacramento, we're faring better.
I think that's partially due to the government policy. So in China, they've had the zero COVID policy. They've had relatively low rates of transmission. They've also had relatively low rates of vaccination compared to California and the U.S. So they have more vulnerability to these outbreaks. And even though they are shutting down cities such as Shanghai, there's still a relatively low rate of transmission that's occurring in China. So I think it's all a result of their philosophy and their policy.
I want to get to the second booster shot. Those who are eligible, according to the CDC, are over 50 years old, immunocompromised, or if you initially had the Johnson & Johnson shot, which is a one-shot vaccine. You know, over 50, that's a big portion of our population. For those individuals, what should they be thinking about?
Yeah, so for those who have comorbidities, for those who are at risk for more severe disease, then I think it's a great idea to get that second booster shot. For others, it's not so clear to me. There's one study from Israel that showed that the booster was very beneficial in those over 60 years of age in decreasing hospital admission as well as mortality. But as far as over 50 years of age, I haven't seen data to that effect yet. And there are other studies that show only a modest increase in the immune response for that second booster dose in this age group. So it's really not clear to me that this applies to everybody. But certainly if you do have comorbidities or if you're going to be at increased risk for exposure and infection, such as if you're traveling to somewhere where there's increased rates of transmission, then it's a good idea to consider that booster.
Given that, you know, you're not sure about the general population, I mean, I'm just curious, getting potentially a fourth shot within, you know, roughly a year time span, what are your concerns with that?
Well, I'm concerned about two things. One is just general vaccine fatigue, that people will get tired of getting the shots and then they won't get them when they need them. For example, we do expect COVID to eventually become a seasonal respiratory disease similar to influenza. So we'd want people to get protected in the fall so that the expected winter surge wouldn't be so severe. The other thing I'm concerned about is that with some vaccines, with repeated doses, that with each dose, there's blunting of the immune response, so that they may not get the protection at the best time for when they need it. And so the FDA is meeting tomorrow to have further discussions about parameters for booster doses and to set out an outline of what those might be in terms of the timing, as well as when we might need updated strains in the booster doses, such as an Omicron-specific booster.
How about therapeutics? Are they widely available at this point?
Yeah, we were concerned about that there would be a shortage, but the therapeutics, the Paxlovid and the Molnupiravir, those are widely available now. We haven't run into shortages, and the monoclonal antibodies are available too.
Where are we in terms of getting a vaccine for children 5 and under? Because that has not happened yet.
Right. So we're in a pretty good place. We're getting close. For Moderna vaccine, for the less than 5-year-olds, data shows that the vaccine is safe and has a good immune response. But the study was performed during the Omicron outbreak and didn't show as much protection as we would like. So the FDA is expected to review the Moderna data sometime later this month. And then we should get CDC recommendations for use maybe at the end of this month or in May. For the Pfizer vaccine, the data is supposed to be available later this month. I haven't seen it. They did run into a glitch with the dosing for the 18 months to the 4 years of age and had to adjust that. And so we'll see what that adjustment, if that has been successful.
You know, when having this conversation, you know, again and again and again, as it evolves, you know, it's like we forget about the flu. What was the flu season like here in Sacramento?
Yeah, the flu season was relatively mild compared to pre-pandemic flu seasons, but it was higher than compared to the previous year. And that's because people, you know, we are back at work, people are back at school. Some people are masking optional instead of the required mandated masking. And so there is more risk for exposure and more risk for transmission. But it's still at least about 10 times lower than a normal flu season.
Well, that's relatively good to hear. Finally, Dr. Blumberg, you know, people are making spring break, summer plans. Some will be flying to not only other states, other countries. What should they keep at front of mind to prepare?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to maintain your flexibility. We're all tired of the pandemic. We want to return to travel, to going on vacation, to normal activities. And so that's great. But you know, things can change. There could be a new variant. There could be another surge. It could be at the destination that you're traveling to. So maintain your flexibility. And I recommend for everybody to make sure you have the travel insurance or refundable tickets for just in case there is that surge.
I mean, that brings up a good point. I mean, given everything that's unfolding here locally in Sacramento, and not to mention a war in Ukraine, what is the one thing you want listeners to be mindful of when it comes to the pandemic that may be taken off the front page? You know, keeping our collective attention, you know, when understandably it may be somewhere else.
Yeah, it's still serious. It still may result in hospitalization. Infection still may result in death. So it's not something to be taken lightly. So I'd encourage everybody to stay up to date with their vaccination status, and then to wear masks, to continue to wear masks in situations where they can't social distance and they don't know the vaccination status of others, such as being on an airplane.
Yeah. Dr. Dean Blumberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Blumberg is the Chief of Pediatric Diseases at UC Davis Medical Center. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producer Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.